This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
In October of 1963, a few days before the final recording session for The Times They Are A-Changin', Bob Dylan took the stage at Carnegie Hall. His latest album was Freewheelin'. It was only 7 months old at the time, but Bob only played three songs from that record in the 15-song set that night. He had too many new ones. One of the songs he played that night, which he had recorded 2 days earlier but would ultimately be left off of The Times They Are A-Changin', was Lay Down Your Weary Tune.
Lay down your weary tune, lay down. Lay down this song you strum.
Only Dylan tape traders and collectors would hear that song for the next 20 years. But one of the people who managed to get his hands on an early bootleg copy was Michael Gray. As Gray wrote Song and Dance Man, the book we've been walking through, he had a lot of Dylan to discuss and analyze. There were already 12 released records, hundreds of songs. And as Gray himself put it, Dylan had changed the course of popular music. Yet out of a decade of songwriting and performing and world-changing, there was one song that seemed to demand special attention. Gray devotes Chapter 6 in Song and Dance Man to Lay Down Your Weary Tune. And in this episode, we talk about why and dig into the things Gray found special about it and look at what other early Dylan writers said about it. To read the full chapter we're discussing, pick up a copy of Song and Dance Man Volume 1. It's available in paperback and on Kindle at Amazon. The discussions in this podcast series highlight points in the book and expand on it in some cases. But trust me, we're barely scratching the surface. If you love Dylan, you'll want to read the full book. The excerpts you'll hear in this chapter were read by Jim Salvucci, who hosts the Dylantants podcast, which is also here on the FM Podcast Network. On that show, Jim and a group of other scholars and researchers talk about Dylan in both interesting interviews and some great roundtable discussions of things like the Fragments box set, the Philosophy of Modern Song, and the recent World of Bob Dylan conference. You can subscribe to the Dylantants in your favorite podcast app. My thanks to Jim for helping us out with the excerpts for this chapter. One quick announcement before we begin. Volume 2 of Song and Dance Man, the 50th anniversary series, is now on sale at Amazon. This book continues where Volume 1 leaves off, covering Dylan's late 70s work, the gospel years, and all those 1980s albums from Empire Burlesque through Oh Mercy. You can order it right now in paperback or on Kindle from Amazon. We will be continuing these episodes to discuss those chapters, so if you like to read ahead, grab yourself a copy. Just search for Song and Dance Man at Amazon or follow the links in the show notes. Now, here's our talk with Michael Gray about the song Lay Down Your Weary Tune. Hi, Michael. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So we've got a short, focused chapter this time. Tell me to start why this song was selected for the spotlight for treatment in this way.
Well, basically because it was unlike anything else, either side of it, in his entire canon. I mean, it just seemed to me, whoa. I mean, I don't know how now I heard it so early on, because certainly it had not been officially released until many, many years after I wrote this chapter. But somehow I heard it on some bootleg. It just made me all the more determined to highlight this chapter. And because nobody had heard it officially, I had to use the whole lyric. And it just didn't fit in with any other particular chapter, you know. I mean, at the time, I wasn't writing it album by album as it tended to be later in the process. I mean, this chapter comes from the very first edition, so I was writing it at the beginning of the 1970s, And, you know, there was no way that it seemed to fit in with any other track. I mean, now I know that it was a Times They Are Changing outtake. And actually, you know, I do sometimes these talks with audio and footage, Bob Dylan's greatest rejected album tracks. I have one more to do this year in Hebden Bridge in West Yorkshire at the end of October. And it's one of the tracks I use as one of his great rejected album tracks. I just think it's a standout piece of writing, and the performance is okay, you know. The performance is fine. It's not as impassioned or, on the other hand, as kind of dispassionate as might be even more appropriate to it, given that it's abolishing I on the whole. And you know, it's a pantheistic vision. That is to say, not that God is everywhere, but that everything is God. You know, every rock, every mountain, every fountain, every slug is God, you know. And that's well, this brings us into the whole discussion of why the song is so different.
Well, here's our first excerpt, something you say about the song and his performance in this chapter.
Dylan's voice on this track is as expressive as ever of distilled, unspecified experience and a fine sensibility, totally engaged. Handled by anyone else, it would not be the same song, which also means that the words of the song have a complexity that demands such a voice as Dylan's. For the whole song, words, music, and performance are all central.
Here's how the song sounded that night at Carnegie Hall.
Struck by the sounds before the sun, I knew the night had gone. The morning breeze like a bugle blew against the drums of dawn. Lay down your weary tune, lay down, lay down the song you strum, and rest yourself neath the strength of strings. No voice can hope to hum the ocean wild like an organ played. The seaweeds wove its strands, the crashing waves like cymbals clashed against the rocks and the sands.
I like the fact that he says, you know, that that it's based on some Scottish folk song melody that he heard at Joan Baez's house one time. And he couldn't remember what it was, and he used it. Well, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's a striking melody. It's nice. But you know, it was really the words that got me. It's a kind of poetic writing that seemed unique. You know, the last of leaves fell from the trees and clung to a new love's breast, i.e. the ground. I mean, that's real poet writing, isn't it? That's not folk song. It's not rock song. It's the way that you could see it on the page as a poet's work from more or less any time, at least from the 19th century onwards, because before that, As I've mentioned before, I think on one of these podcasts of ours, these many podcasts of ours, It's before the Romantic poets, nobody liked mountains and stuff. They thought they were rubble. They're described as rubble before Wordsworth and Coleridge said mountains are great.
To this end of how different it is, we're going to talk a little bit today about some of what John Baldy talked about, and he had this observation about this song. The song does mark the development of poetic thought in a way that Hard Rain's Gonna Fall had done before it.
I can see what he means. This is from his book, The Chameleon Poet, which is published by Root, British publishing house, that also published my outtakes on Bob Dylan in 2021, which is still available, by the way. I can see what he means because, you know, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall came out of nowhere with all these extraordinary visual images. Certainly it wasn't like any of his other early songs, and it was very long, and it was kind of rhapsodic, if you like. It was visionary. It was just this kind of cacophony of visions seen and heard, and so to that extent, this is like it in that it's completely different, and it's visionary, and it's very poetic in a kind of more traditionally poetic way. But I don't think the two songs are strikingly alike in the world they represent. I think for example, the Hard Rain's Gonna Fall is locked into its folk roots, the whole structure of it, and the whole way that the way that images emerge from it. Whereas this has one kind of unity that there's no equivalent of in Hard Rain, I don't think. And that unity is that all these sounds and natural world aspects that he brings into Lay Down Your Weary Tune, they are all described as if parts of an orchestra. You know, everything sounds like a banjo or like an orchestra in some way, and in that sense it's very cohesive. You know, he uses this analogy of the natural world being one great big orchestra. He uses that all through the song.
Let's hear a few more verses of that metaphor, this time from Billy Bragg covering the song for Amnesty International.
I stood unwound beneath the sky, the clouds unbound by lords, the crying rain like a trumpet sang. And as for your word pulls me down, your weary to lay down the song you've strung, and rest yourself neath the strength of streams.
I read the Goldberg piece, and he kind of dismisses early Dylan, and you point out, you quote him in the book, but you like certain parts of what he's done and maybe less others. But reading his full original article, which for everyone's benefit is in a book you can get called The Early Years, a Bob Dylan Retrospective, edited by Craig McGregor.
Craig McGregor was an Australian, and he pioneered putting a bunch of articles about Dylan into a collection, into a book. And one of them is this Stephen Goldberg piece. It's a long time since I looked at it, but I remember, you know, my own use of it and yes, he's not interested in early Bob Dylan's work because early Bob Dylan is interested in the sort of political world, in the everyday world, the mundane world that we all spend most of our time ploughing through. And Goldberg is interested in this song because he's interested in another world, a kind of mystical world. he's not a sort of straightforward Christian believer. He's not a Buddhist or anything like that. But he's a mystic. He believes that there's some kind of great throbbing thing that that binds us all to the universe. So the nearest thing he gets to a traditional kind of view is of pantheism, which, as I say, is this thing that God is in everything. God is everything. And this is a romantic poet's viewpoint too. God is in every daffodil for Wordsworth and so on. But one of the points I make in this chapter is that Dylan is not a natural mystic. You know, you don't write all that early political stuff and hustle your way through to New York and do all this performing in Greenwich Village and so on. You don't do all that because you are glowing with mysticism. You do it because you're a young punk who wants to be successful and who has ambition on a scale that very few of us suspected at the time, and which he probably suspected very strongly about himself all along. And so, yeah, Dylan is not a natural mystic, and that's part of... and so when I talk about... you know, I quote Goldberg because he has a convenient way of explaining what he's on about.
Isn't it amazingly astute of Goldberg to point it out as signaling some change? A song more strikingly different from Dylan's earlier output would be impossible to imagine. All the same, it's a song that has received less attention than almost any other in the whole of Dylan's repertoire. So that it's of interest that Goldberg should focus on it at all. And no other song could enforce for me so strong a sense of the acid mystic equation's validity. Goldberg cites it in terms of mysticism. I would cite it as Dylan's first acid song, the first concentrated attempt to give a hint of the unfiltered world and a supremely successful creation. Goldberg refers elsewhere in his article to Dylan's having heard the universal melody. Nothing could better substantiate the spirit of such a claim than Lay Down Your Weary Tune, one of the very greatest and most haunting creations in our language.
But, you know, I'm immediately, from my own experience at that point of Bob Dylan and what he did in the world, my immediate thought was, well, if he's not a natural mystic, then where... How does he arrive at being attuned to this level of mysticism, which the song appears to evince? And how is it most likely that he would get there? Drugs.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But okay. You hit on exactly the point I wanted to make about Goldberg, which is it feels to me like something Bob has to put up with a lot. He had something he wanted to find, or a story he wanted to tell, and he needed to find something in Dylan's work that he could reverse engineer and say, Bob did this for this reason.
I like the reverse engineering way of putting it. Yeah. I mean, he has an agenda, and this is the Bob he fixes on, because this is the one that fits his agenda. Well, fine. But I mean, I think, you know, when we're talking about this particular period in Bob's life, this is where he is, as well as being, you know, the very ambitious young guy that I was characterizing him as a little while back. He's also a very open to different experience and different people's influences. You know, he's influenced by so many people. You know, you've only got to see the way that Woody Guthrie's work grabbed him very early on to see that. And he's influenced by Dave Van Ronk in Greenwich Village. He's influenced by finding the French symbolist poets. He's open. He's always part of his bravery, I think, is that he has never been determined not to look beyond what's directly in front of him. He's always been prepared to look at stuff coming in from the sides, but without being derailed by it, you know. I mean, and when we're talking about his use of drugs, you know, I mean, most people, if they find acid, let's say, and they have a really profound experience under its influence, then, you know, they're likely to go down that rabbit hole. Bob never does, but he's open to it.
I think that's a hugely important Bob Dylan observation, actually. We all think of how diverse the music is, how diverse everything is, even within periods, as we've seen looking through the early albums. And we know that's unique, but I think you just kind of described it in a way that allows us to think about it.
You know, there would have been people on that scene as early as 63, 64. There would have been people in the world that he was moving within who did talk to him about things like mysticism and God and you know, a higher level of consciousness than the political. I'm sure he was aware by then that one way of seeing the world was that there is a higher level of consciousness than bickering about senators and congressmen and all that stuff and protesting about war and so on. I think there has to have been a side of Bob that was interested right from the beginning. I mean, actually, you know, when he talks about the effect of being from Minnesota and from Hibbing, from that iron ore country, he talks about vibes from the ground and, you know, the kind of, he talks in a semi-mystical way sometimes about that early upbringing.
This is kind of...
Even though on a rational level, you know, he lives in a middle-class house with middle-class parents, his father has a middle-class job, and, you know, he goes to an exceptionally good school. But at the same time, he talks about the iron in the ground having an effect on people and so on.
But this is kind of my point in the sense that he can respond to nature. He can appreciate the significance of things in the world without it being a leap to mysticism or a nod to mysticism. And all I'm saying, again, for the purpose of sort of stratifying this, is that Bob could, you know, he realizes there's beauty and deep natural beauty in all of these things. He obviously also realizes that something happens with music that is unlike other things, that music also has this power. He draws the analogy, writes the song Stop, and I'm kind of thinking about this the way people, a lot of people listen, because a lot of people wouldn't, mysticism and these, the fact that that's God is in everything would never occur to them. And it possible it didn't even occur to Bob in that kind of specific sense. It was just a song,
okay,
for whatever, yeah, reason. Let's go to an excerpt from the book. In this one, you talk about this relationship between the natural world and music.
And by its very impingement, it urges the felicity of Dylan's analogies between nature's effects and the sounds of musical instruments. As it flows through each line with a graceful and liquid precision, the melody nurtures and sustains us in an awareness of how involving and creative such analogies are made to be. The tune, in fact, offers itself as an embodiment of the river's mirror. Its water smooth does indeed run like a hymn.
Just in a craftsman-like way, he's extremely effective in this song, in the songwriting, of taking that idea, nature's beautiful, music's magical, I'm going to analogize, yeah, them.
It is. And I don't know any other song like that. I mean, you know, I'm sure there are 100 songs that that enthuse about music and nature, and maybe even in the same verse. But there's nothing that does what this song does, which really is, it wraps it all up into one inseparable fused whole. It's the song enacts what the song is talking about. Yeah.
In talking about Nashville Skyline last time, you I think said, you know, you can't like Bob at all and not like Nashville Skyline. And I feel like this song, even the non-Dylan folks in the world, it would be hard to listen to the song and not say, oh, that's kind of a lovely song.
Yeah. They might think the chorus comes around too often and gets a bit wearying. I sometimes feel that myself, but not always.
Building on this theme of what's there and what we put there, here's a paragraph from Baldy about a literalist view of the lyric that I wanted to talk about.
The tune that the poet has been singing is seen to be a weary one, in need of being laid to rest. The poet is granted a hearing of a universal music which man, in his inadequacy, is incapable of even approximating, having no hope to hum, let alone play or sing along with it. Yet seemingly, all creation, save man, contributes to the orchestra which makes the music.
So it's a lovely paragraph. It seems to me as maybe taking things a bit literally, in that the weary tune needs to be laid to rest, to me, doesn't intentionally evoke forever. It's not saying quit and go home. It's saying potentially take a rest, look around. You know, there's a lot of reasons to rest. And one is just to look around. I'm not making an argument, but I think that, you know, no hope to hum, you know, the idea that no hope to hum means you're not in the league of this stuff.
Yes.
It's a fine thought to put out and let people think that way, but it's also possible that's not what it is. No hope to hum means you're not going to be that good. That's okay. Appreciate that. You'll be better tomorrow because you appreciated it.
I think that Baldy is suggesting that there is this, that Bob is evoking this universal music, and that people, individual egos, are not up to it. But of course, it's an individual Bob who has created all this. you know, it's. I think we might be rather too used to the idea that Bob sort of throws words together with an instinctive sense of what'll work and what won't, and that therefore we don't often consider that he might very carefully work out A to B to C to D through the course of a song. And this is a song where I think he does, you know. You can't have that long list of analogies between wind and an instrument, rain and an instrument, a river and a sound, and all that. You can't have that much without it having been deliberately edited by its author, at the very least.
Well, the archives have taught us that, right? That no one works harder. There's never an end to finding replacement for any word. So I think that's clear. I think this is earlier than we have many manuscripts, but maybe not. I wonder. This is another one that I'd be curious to see what the evolution, if they have anything on that.
Yeah, I don't think there is. I'm not sure, but I haven't seen it.
I think the reality is probably, and maybe we have proof of this, it both happen, meaning some of the songs flow from the pen pretty much as they end up. And some of them are Joker Man, and there's 42 pages of versions.
It reminds me of what he says about every grain of sand, which is, you know, he didn't know what it was, but he just he just had to get it down before he lost it. And I can mm-hmm. imagine that this is exactly how Lay Down Your Weary Tune happened. You know, he had a flash or two of one of these things, and then the rest piled in on him, into his head, and he got it down as best he could. And whether he edited it afterwards, who knows? But it's a very edited, finished work. There's nothing where you think that bit doesn't fit. There's nothing where you think that's a poor line. None of it. It gels. It works within itself beautifully.
So let's listen to another excerpt where you talk about some of this.
Part of the sense mingling achieved by the crying rain, like a trumpet sang, is surrealistic. Fleetingly, we get a visual image of the rain becoming a trumpet. This belies the effect of that crying, because to transform itself from silver gray to gold into a singing trumpet, the rain must pour out, if not upwards, horizontally, like musical notes on a sheet of manuscript. It is a tribute to Dylan's achievement that we can accept in passing this strangeness of effect without finding it a distraction.
Yeah, I don't know that I necessarily picture it quite as, you know, literally as that when I hear it. I just like the crying rain like a trumpet sang. And Ask for No Applause, of course, is you know, a thing he likes revisiting in later songs. Bird on a Fence, singing his song for me at his own expense. And that's not the only one either. But I think the element of mysticism is important. And I think that it sort of fits with, you know, being able to be so attentive to the rain and the wind and the river and all these things. It sort of fits, and it fits with Goldberg's kind of theme too. It reminds me of a famous bit of George Eliot's Middlemarch, in which he says, "The quickest of us walk around well wadded with stupidity." Because if you were really, this is summarizing her now, if you were really attuned to the minutiae of ordinary life, then she does really say this is a direct quote, then you would hear the grass grow and the squirrel's heartbeat, and you would die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence. That sort of higher consciousness is what this song is an attempt to capture with its fundamental analysis of music and the natural world.
Here's a bit of the original Goldberg article following that path, maybe to its extreme.
It was at this point that Dylan was preparing to become an artist in the Zen sense. He was searching for the courage to release his grasp on all the layers of distinctions that give us meaning, but by virtue of their inevitably setting us apart from the life flow, preclude our salvation. All such distinctions, from petty jealousies and arbitrary cultural values, to the massive, but ultimately irrelevant, confusions engendered by psychological problems, all the endless repetitions that those without faith grasp in order to avoid their own existence, all these had to be released. The strength, the faith necessary for this release, was to be a major theme of Dylan's for the next 3 years.
This is where I think he's beyond the pale. Bob's sitting there, you know, plotting his Zen release.
Yeah. I think most of what he's looking at, mostly he's looking at the bob of Nashville skyline, i.e. the bob of the end of the 60s, rather than the bob of 1963 to 4. And, you know, Bob was deliberately letting go his grip on political statement, if you like. He was moving into a more attuned to nature phase, you know. He was living in the country. He was enjoying family. He was more attuned to this world.
So let's wrap up talking about, you said at the beginning, the song's unique in terms of what came before it. Is there any echoes later?
I don't know. Off the top of my head, no, I don't know. It doesn't seem to me that it fits with anything else in his canon. You know, I think if there are the song that's most like it, sort of superficially, if you like, is Tomorrow is a Long Time.
Mm.
With Beauty and Singing Rivers.
But, right.
But that's more or less the same period, isn't it?
It'd be an interesting list to make. I mean, if Dogs Run Free, you've got a few other songs that just are far out of the normal Venn diagram of Bob Dylan songs.
Yeah.
This is what's interesting, I mean, because I don't think most people would identify it as being as distinct as it is upon kind of closer inspection, right? It almost feels folkish if you don't think about the content and the delivery. You know, you make a lot about, and other people have, about Dylan's, you know, the voice and the way he sings this particular song, both on the record. And I listened mostly today to the Town Hall or the Carnegie Hall recording. It's a very, very nice version of it. You know, and it's certainly there's a calmness and an element of the voice of this kind of delivery, obviously, we've heard before. And yet I do think it helps to say, wow, this one really is different. It's worth noticing that.
Yeah. We haven't talked much about Bob's use of drugs here. And perhaps we don't need to, because it's all speculation anyway. But for myself, I would say that, you know, the only drug likely to give you a sense that you're in tune with the universal chord would be either acid or mushrooms.
In the beginning of the chapter, I didn't pull any excerpts from it, but the beginning of the chapter really does sort of beautifully make that point and go into the, well, explain your thinking on that and kind of justify it.
Dylan is not a natural visionary in the sense that Blake is. Being an artist, he has vision, but that vision has not encompassed mysticism unaided. Everyday concerns abound in his work. His early self-immersion in the blues, his absorbed concern for music generally, and his songs of socio-political comment, songs full of the signs of competitive ego, surface ideology, and Western logic, and infused with Old Testament concepts of vengeance. No way is Dylan's mind intrinsically Eastern. Dylan's mysticism must have come through drugs as well as literature.
The vinyl collection of Biograph behind me here, of course, was the first time that Lay Down Your Weary Tune was officially released. So that's 1985.
Yeah.
More than 20 years after it was created.
So did you hear from people who at the time weren't in the trading circle and really wanted to know about the song you were writing about, since you were brave enough to put it out 20 years before the masses got their hands on it?
I can't remember that. I know there was, you know, it was a very different world of passing things around then. Very different world. You know, I would go and see someone who lived in a farmhouse 100 miles away, you know, and if I was lucky, I'd come away with something that they had. You know, that's how it was then.
What was the mode of distribution, since, you know, double cassette decks and certainly, you know, CD burning wasn't how were things shared? How did you get them usually?
Yeah, well, a lot of it was cassette by the time I was working.
Okay.
It was cassette. They were the they were the things that young people around 1970 had and knew how to work. And their parents couldn't fathom how the buttons worked. The other thing that we don't mention here is, but which is in the chapter, is that that it chimes with the Tolkien poetry in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I had no reference or relation to that, so it was hard for me to take in because you've just repeated everything I know, which is there's a book called Tolkien or by Tolkien called Lord of the Rings, and that's the end of my knowledge of it.
Oh, well, I guess most people now would know it as a film, a series of films, but I haven't seen the film and wouldn't want to. But the book, it's a big book, and Tolkien was a professor who was interested in languages, and he created this whole world. And in 1968, when I was struggling, I had a job. Perhaps it was 69. I had a job with a company called Educational Productions Limited, and they were in East Ardsley in Yorkshire. And to get there, I had to get a bus to the station, and then a train, and then another bus. And in the winter, this bus was a very snowy bus ride, double-decker bus, through a kind of fairly barren part of the countryside. And I was absolutely gripped by this huge book, and the wintry scene outside seemed to allow me to be completely focused on the book. But anyway, within the book, which is a grand fantasy, there is this humble, modest character called Frodo, and he sings songs, and some of the songs, as I say in the book, fit completely to the tune of Lay Down Your Weary Tune, the songs of Lothlorien. Yeah. Occasionally when I play this track at a talk, I venture to sing a verse from one of these Tolkien songs to the tune of Lay Down Your Weary Tune, just to show how very neatly they fit together. But somehow I can't imagine Bob Dylan reading Lord of the Rings.
Well, so we have this lovely song that sets apart from the catalog and yet fits in the larger world of Bob Dylan. All these data points, all these songs in all their edges of the universe seem to help the whole thing stand up. So I'm glad you called our attention to this one.
Thanks for listening. This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. Visit us at fmpods.com.